So we haven't been chanting the title of this gatha, which is what we usually do, but I guess that hasn't been transmitted, but the title is Gatha on Opening the Sutra. So it's a chant that usually the chant leader chants the title, and then we all join in with the rest of it. So interesting, because we don't actually even have any sutra that we're opening here, you know, literally. However, in Zen, in our path, you are the sutra. And we even say that Kinin, you know, Maizumi Roshi said the translation of that is sutra walking. Sutras walking. So, you know, Adayan pointed out how we walk. It's not one, we stop and then we take another step, we stop, we take another step. It's one continuous collective step of sutras walking. So this gatha, a chant on opening the sutra. So we're opening us. The Dharma, infinitely subtle, incomparably profound. Subtle does not mean hidden. Doesn't mean far away, or doesn't even mean like unseen. It means it's right here. It's infinitely so subtle. It's so close that we can't see it. It's this. It's right here. Just this right now. That's the Dharma. That's the sutra that we're opening. Incomparably profound. More profound than that vast ocean, more profound than space, incomparably profound, because nothing, we can't measure it, nothing is beyond it, nothing is not it, just this, just you, right here, right now, that's it. So then we say, okay, it's infinitely subtle, incomparably profound. Now we see it, hear it, receive, and maintain it. We always see it, we always hear it, but we don't. It's always being said, it's always right here, but we don't. And we don't receive it, therefore, although we don't, maybe we receive it, but we don't realize we're receiving it. And we fail to maintain it in that sense. And you know, when we've been talking about, how can we rearrange our organization of our group or something, it's just about that. It's just about seeing, hearing, receiving, and maintaining the Dharma. That's it. It's not about, like, we have to do some extraordinary thing, create like structures and organizations and YouTube channels and whatever, you know. It's really just about seeing, hearing, receiving, and maintaining the Dharma, which is nothing other than you in your life, right here, right now. All of us, each of us. So now we see it, hear it, receive, and maintain it. May we truly, completely, fully realize the Tathagata's true meaning. The Tathagata being the Buddha, who gave us this way of experiencing the Dharma. He was a really good pedagogue in a sense, because he saw this way of how he could present it. He didn't discover anything new. No, he just had a different way of presenting it that has shown its worth because it's survived, all these 2,000, more than 2,500 years. And how has it survived? Because each person sees it, hears it, receives and maintains it. It's the only only way. Otherwise, it's dead. And each of us is it in our own particular, unique manifestation. And each of us manifests it, sees it, hears it, receives, and maintains it in our own way. So whoever sits here opens the sutra in a different way. So Lisa was sitting here yesterday, she opens the sutra in a different way. And each of us always are opening the sutra. However, we give this form, this it's like a river that has banks. The banks, are the relative form that help us to see, hear, receive, and maintain it. When we're out there in the meetings and when we're doing our cleaning and when we're sitting out having our tea, the context is different, and so we don't have our attention focused on seeing, hearing, receiving, and maintaining the Dharma. It's there. We are it at that moment as well. It's not somewhere else. Our attention is usually not focused on it. It's so subtle. Someone said, I think it was the American writer Natalie Goldberg, who has done a lot about around writing practice. She was a Zen, she is a Zen practitioner, and she was a student of Katagiri Roshi, who was one of the Zen pioneers in the US, along with Suzuki and Mizumi. And she said in one of her books, and which really struck me, was that she realized, we have this question of what's your original face? Or who are you? Or what is your true nature? These questions. Or even this, the Dharma, infinitely subtle. So we say it's right here. It's so subtle that we can't see it because it's right here. She said it's like trying to turn your head fast enough to see your face. You can't, as soon as you turn your head, well, your face is turned too. So as soon as we start looking for it, saying it's this or that, it's not. It's before. It's before those words. It's before those categories. It's infinitely subtle. It's just this. You are it. You are this Dharma. You are the way. You are the precious treasure. So we have this saying in the Zen tradition, the treasury of the true Dharma eye and subtle mind of Nirvana. This comes from, well, it's in a koan, I'll tell you the koan, but Dogen, one of our great ancestors, has a whole collection called the Shobo Genzo, which is the treasury of the true Dharma eye. So what is that treasury of the true Dharma eye? Well, it's you. You are the treasury of the true Dharma eye. However, you don't think that, you don't believe that, you don't see that. Or you might sometimes. You might have this, yes, of course. But that's it. This treasury of the true Dharma eye is you are it. So the koan that's involved with that is where we hear this in our tradition, apart from Dogen's Shobogenzo. It's supposedly the first, and this is purely Zen, other Buddhist traditions don't focus on this. It's purely Zen. The first transmission, as we say, from a teacher to a student. And then from there, the whole line from 84 generations to me continued. So the first one is Shakyamuni. whom we call the Buddha. And he had this disciple who was called Kashapa or Kasho. In Japanese, it's Kasho. And you know, he was a historic person. We know they both were historic. We know that they existed, and Kasho was part of, you know, the Buddhist Sangha community at the time. But this story of the first transmission, we don't know if it was actually fact or if, you know, Zen has just created this mythology around it. Even if they created this legend and mythology around it, what it says is true. So even if this is an invented interaction, what is there is true. And that's what the entire teaching is about. So Buddha goes onto the Shakyamuni, goes up to give his talk like this, and there's a large assembly. Sometimes we say it was hundreds of people there. In the koan, it doesn't really say how many people it is. And he goes up there and he picks up a flower. He holds up the flower and smiles. That's it. No, it doesn't even smile. He just holds up the flower. In some versions, he twirls the flower. In any case, he's just there with a flower that he holds up.
Which flower do we know of?
I'm sure, you know, there's probably specialists who have gone into that and said it has to be this flower because of this, whatever. I don't know. But as soon as we get into that, well, then we're getting into naming and categories, and then we make it special. That special flower has to be held up and all this stuff. So he holds up this flower, and no one does anything. Everyone is just sitting there, except Kasho, who smiles. And at this point, the Buddha says, I have, actually, I should get the direct quote instead of just paraphrasing. The direct quote that's in the translation of the Mumenkan that we use, right? So there's like other translations of the Mumenkan, there's other translations of this, but so he says, he holds up a flower. Kasho smiles. He says, I have the all-pervading true Dharma. This is, I have the treasury of the true Dharma, I, incomparable nirvana, subtle mind of nirvana, exquisite teaching of formless form. It does not rely on letters and is transmitted outside scriptures. I now hand it to Mahakasho, Maha being great, unsurpassable. So we say this is the first transmission in our lineage. In all of Zen lineages, this is the first transmission. And in every transmission, we say that is what is transmitted. So the all-pervading true Dharma, incomparable nirvana, exquisite teaching of formless form. It sounds like this absolutely amazing thing, right? And it's just this. That's why it doesn't matter what flower it was. Just this. Just this. Exquisite teaching of formless form. It doesn't say no form. It's saying the formless form. It doesn't rely on letters and is transmitted outside scriptures. So this is the hallmark of Zen. This is Bodhidharma, you know, coming to China from India, saying, I have this teaching that strikes to the heart of man, woman, person, being. Doesn't rely on the scriptures. It's outside of the sutras. It's outside the sutras because you are the sutras. So what do we need to be written down somewhere? You're it already. Of course, it helps we have, you know, I have these notes here. It helps to have those things, but that's not what it is. That's not the teaching, actually. Teaching is you. You are this all-pervading true Dharma, incomparable nirvana, exquisite teaching of formless form. Now, in this transmission moment, the reason that we say that the transmission was made is because Kasho that moment knows that. He knows, it's him. He knows that. He has a direct experience of that. And that's why we say that's the first transmission. What's interesting is then, the second transmission is from Kasho to the Buddha's cousin, Ananda. And Ananda was the Buddha's assistant, loyal, devoted, he was much younger than the Buddha, devoted, unfailing, always present, everywhere, went everywhere with the Buddha, was present for all of his teachings, even if it was with one person, if it was a huge group, if it was with the king, if whatever. Ananda was there. And for 40 years. And Ananda knew everything the Buddha had ever said. And whenever someone wanted to know what did the Buddha say, Ananda could recite it and tell everyone. And, you know, it took the form of what the sutras, the official sutras then took the form was, thus I have heard. This is what I heard the Buddha say. Ananda could repeat it. But in the Buddha's lifetime, Ananda, he knew it all the sutras, he knew every word, but he hadn't directly realized that for himself.
Is it possible?
What?
Is it possible to know the whole Buddhist sutras and not realize?
Oh, there's lots of university professors who know all the sutras and know all the history of Buddhism, know everything about all the lives, you know. Same with the church, you know. The lives of the saints, there's lots of people who know it all. But they don't know it. They don't know it intimately in their hearts. They haven't experienced that they are that treasury. So Ananda was, that was Ananda's story. So at this point, in this second transmission story that we have, Ananda once said to Kasho, the world-honored one, the Buddha, Shakyamuni, transmitted to you the brocade robe. So when we receive a transmission, we get these fancy robes, you know? And we get these fancy rakus. I don't actually wear my fancy robe, except for ceremony, you know, like official type things. But, so the world honored one transmitted to you the brocade robe. There's a story about that, which I'll come back to. What else did he transmit? Kasho called out, Ananda. Ananda answered, yes, sir. Kasho said, pull down the flagpole at the gate. The flagpole at the gate was raised when a Dharma talk would begin, when a teaching would begin, and it was taken down when the teaching was finished. So, Ananda says, he transmitted to you this robe, this fancy, beautiful robe. What else did he give you? What else did he transmit? Kasho calls out, Ananda! Ananda answers, yes, sir. Kasho said, pull down the flagpole. Teaching's finished. Teaching's right there. So what was he telling him? What was transmitted? Ananda was transmitted. But we don't know that. At the fact that this story was kept, we're assuming that that's when Ananda realized it, that he got it at that moment. He is what is transmitted. And therefore, there's nothing transmitted. The true treasury, the treasury of the true Dharma eye cannot be transmitted because you are it. It's you. The subtle mind of Nirvana, it's yours. It's not some other mind. It's not someone else's mind. It's yours. You are that. That's my Dharma name. You are that. You are it. My Dharma name is not I am that. It's you are that. Which is a much more subtle teaching that my subtle teacher gave me. So the story of the beautiful brocade robe, I don't even remember where I read this, but I read this somewhere about, you know, talking about the history and whatever. That Kasho was like a nobleman. He was like, you know, a merchant or something. in the Buddha's time. And he had heard about the Buddha's teachings, and he went and he wanted to study with the Buddha and practice with his community. And so the Buddha had asked all of his disciples to, you know, give up their, whatever their clothes were and whatever their possessions were, and to take scraps of fabric from other sources that were given, that were donated, and make their clothing, so make their robe. And that's why our robes and our little rakusus like this are made from strips, because that's what the original Buddha's, and then of course it has all these meanings, these rakusu strips and all of this, but the original idea was that to follow the Buddha's way of just wearing what was given to us and repairing it and putting pieces of fabric together. So Kashyapa shows up with this fabulous robe. And the Buddha said, okay, yeah, you can join our Sangha and everything. But how about if we exchange robes? And so this was the Buddha's way of, like, you know, he knew that, of course, Kashyapa would want the Buddha's robe, even though it was basically rags. But he also wanted him to give up his beautiful, lovely thing, you know, that he was walking around in and probably was identified with. And Kashyapa, because he was so attracted by the Buddha and everything, we don't know psychologically what he went through to have to take off this beautiful piece of clothing and put on rags, but we can imagine it was probably something. And so he did. And this somehow became, in Kashyapa's mind, the Buddha gave me his robe. And we continue this. Even, you know, we say, so the kesa that I receive with transmission, what we receive, we say that's the robe of the Buddha. And like, even during the transmission ceremony, there's all these gifts we get. So we get the leg of the Buddha, the arm of the Buddha, the, you know, the head of the Buddha. We get all these things, which, like, it's a big stick and a littler stick and a stick with hair, with horse hair on it, and you know, bowls. I got my eating bowls that are all, like, supposedly to represent the Buddha, something, a part of the Buddha, right? And I don't know if, you know, the brocade robe and the Zen thing, but I have read, historians have said that that's the origin of Buddha giving Kashyapa his robe as a teaching. I don't know what Kashyapa got out of that, because apparently he wasn't so cool, actually, Kashyapa, after the Buddha died, and he was responsible for, like, imposing certain rules and excluding some people and things like that. But this is what historians say, but I don't know. Maybe he also felt it was necessary to maintain the community to do that. You know, when a powerful teacher like that dies, the community, all kinds of stuff happens in the communities. And it's tough for the person who is following and has inherited it to hold it together. And as the first successor, I know that I am the one who's going to have to do that someday when my teacher is no longer there. Maybe it will be perfectly fine and peaceful and everything will be all right. But we know that that's the kind of thing that happens. So let's give Kashyapa the benefit of the doubt and think that he was doing what he felt was best, which I think he probably was. In any case, what is transmitted is, you know, the treasury of the true Dharma I, the all-pervading true Dharma.
Yeah, when you say I, it's E-Y-E or it's I?
The treasury of the true Dharma I? Yeah, it's I.
Okay.
It's not I.
Don't be
right. Right. And, you know, so this sounds like really elaborate and amazing. And the Shobogenzo is, like, very, you know, considered the most, you know, exquisite work in all of Zen. And although at the time it wasn't. Dogen was kind of this obscure guy who didn't have a lot of students. And kind of disappeared for 500 years or more, even more, because he was in the 13th century, and it was only until, like, I think 19th century that he was really brought back. and people discovered him, and now he's like venerated as this great, not only within Zen and Buddhism, but as a great philosopher. So the Shobo Genzo is like this Bible or something. Actually, the treasury of the true Dharma eye is nothing other than you. So very simple, very direct. Just this, just this, just this. When I was a very young Zen student, and I'm just looking to see if there was something I wanted to say about that. No. I had just started, actually, practice for about a year, and it was the week of that I was going to receive Jukai with six of my companions. And so I'm sitting there in the Daisan line waiting for my turn. Actually, not far from Pont de Barre, I've told you about that place. And someone that we know from Pont de Barre knows that place. Yeah. And I'm sitting there waiting for my turn, and this was a place that was set up by a longtime Zen practitioner, not from our lineage, from the Deshi Maru lineage. And so it was, you know, it was a nice country type place, but it had kind of a lot of real kind of Zen-y stuff in it. And so waiting in line, and it was outside on a porch, and on this table, like a low table, there were some books, and the top book on the table was one of these, what we call coffee table books. You know, big, beautiful photo, book of photos and things like this, you know, really nice book. And on the cover was this beautiful photo of a beautiful bowl, incense bowl, you know, one of these amazing Japanese things, and a, you know, long stick of incense, and the smoke was burning just perfectly in the photo. And the title of the book was The Essence of Zen. And I already was like, had kind of this rebellious temperament, and I looked at that, I'm sitting there waiting in line, you know, and I look at that book, and I'm like, that's not the essence of Zen. That is not the essence of Zen. I'm getting like, you know, it's not the essence of Zen, that thing. And waiting for my turn, and so then I look up and kind of in the courtyard, kind of in there. There was this scrawny little tree. Didn't have many leaves. I don't know if it was, I don't think it was dead, but it was not. You would not look at it and say, that's this beautiful, you know, flower that you imagine being held up by the Buddha, right? This scrawny little tree. And suddenly I had this, that's the essence of Zen. That tree, that's the essence. That is not the essence. Of course, this is a huge duality I'm making, right? That's the essence and this isn't. But you gotta remember, I was a young student and I didn't really know that much. But I knew that. I knew that what was being said by that book with that beautiful photo and all this was like missing what's outside the sutras. I knew that just intuitively, instinctively. My experience was that. So then later in the week, you know, I do the Jukai ceremony with my comrades, and my teacher gives me this name, you are that. And I just wept throughout the whole ceremony. I'd never seen a Jukai ceremony before. Like most of you, when you have received your rakusus, you've already seen and experienced a ceremony. This was the first time my teacher was giving Jukai, so I'd never seen it before. And the whole thing was just, I just was completely ripped open by it. And then I get this name, you are that, and I am that little tree, you know? I am actually that beautiful incense bowl. That was harder to take, but the little tree, no problem. This is like realizing that you are the treasury of the true Dharma eye. It doesn't mean that after that, you know, this was like more than 30 years ago, it doesn't mean that I forgot, that I didn't forget, you know. Of course, you lose sight of that. And then we have to come back, and we have to come back, and we have to come back. But having heard that, you know, hearing that you are the treasury of the true Dharma eye, that your life as it is right here, right now, Okay, you hear that. You may not experience that, but having heard it and then trusting that, at some moment, you do have that experience. And then, even if you forget it, you know that experience. You know it, and so it's not as distant or subtle as it was before, because you've had that experience. The experience is impermanent, of course, like that smoke on the incense and the beautiful picture. Impermanent. But once you know it, you know it. And that's it. Of course, it has to be realized again and again, actualized, deepened, embodied. That's the hardest part, is to embody it, you know? Realizing it is actually not so difficult, but embodying it, that's the challenge. The ultimate, though, is to appreciate your life as it is, because then you have a better chance of realizing that you are the treasury of the true Dharma eye. And then you can better take care of it, you know, better take care of your life, better take care of seeing, hearing, receiving, and maintaining the Dharma, whatever it is. All the teachings, everything throughout the entire Zen tradition, I even could be considered a heretic. Maybe I shouldn't say it in this Catholic place, but even the Christ's message was that as well. He didn't use the same words of the treasury of the true Dharma eye, but, you know, that's what he was saying. You are the way. You are the light. You know, of course, he says, I am, but you are nothing else. Love, you know, the message of Christ, the message of Buddha, the message of every spiritual tradition throughout space and time comes to that same place in their own way, because each of us manifests it in a different way. So the Zen tradition chooses to call it the treasury of the true Dharma eye, or Mu, or it. But it's that, it's you, it's this, it's right here, right now. So subtle, infinitely subtle. So all the teachings point to this. And you know, we can look at so all the koans are about that, for those of you who practice with koans. It's all about that, and about realizing that. And as with the koans, the answer, as it were, has to come from your own life. It can't come from a book. I recently saw something on the internet, some like some book about koans or something, but it was like almost with drawings, you know. And so it said, so it was saying the answer to the koan is in this drawing, you know. Well, I don't even know what that means. You know? I don't even know what that means. Maybe you can look at that and be inspired and wake up to who you truly are. And maybe that's what they meant, but I don't think it was. I think it was like an attempt to say, okay, this is, you can offer this answer to your teacher, and your teacher will ring the bell and say no. You know, but maybe not. Maybe not. You know, so I sit here and I tell you, it's just this, it's just this, it's just this. My teacher said basically the same thing. So I went through a phase with koan practice, as I've told you, where I would go in and I had such a deep realization of just this, that whatever the koan was, my response was just this. And she would ding, 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 ding. No. Every koan I would say, it was in French, so it was ça. Every koan I would give the answer, ça. No, 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 no. I'm exaggerating when I say every koan, but I would begin with that. That it was a total concept. Had nothing to do with actual treasury of the true Dharma I. Living, being, appreciating this here and now. It's just a concept. Sa. You know, sometimes on one particular koan, I was so annoyed that I even got to the point of like pounding on the ground. Sa. You know, like, it's this. Well, nope. Ding, 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 ding. So we have to be careful, you know. It can easily become conceptual. My life is the way. I am it. And that's why it's good my teacher didn't give me, I am it, it's you are it. Because as soon as we fix it, then it's become duality. The response to this moment can only be right here in this moment. We can plan, we can train, you know, so we have training for, what do you call that, premier secours, you know, like...
First aid.
What, like...
First aid?
Yeah, first aid, yeah. So we train for that. And we learn a lot of things to do and techniques and how to respond and everything, but in that moment, we don't really know. We don't know how we're going to respond. The response can only come from that very moment, from this very moment. Right here, right now. That's the absolute beauty of life, is that it's always new. You know, it's always changing. The situation is never the same. So, let's just go back to that first aid example. We have all these, you know, things that we learn. I've, you know, did basic first aid when I was probably 15 or something, but I hadn't forgotten most of it. But so you learn all, you know, this is what you do, all, you know, how to treat whatever the urgent thing is. And that it's excellent to know those things because it saves lives. But when you do it on an actual living person, it's not the same thing as on that dummy that you were practicing on, right? Because that dummy was not alive. In English, we actually call that a dummy. I don't know what you call it in Portuguese. You know, you have like a figure that you train with, but not a living being. Do you have a name for that? Like a doll, kind of.
Yeah.
I don't know why we call it a dummy in English, but it's not alive. You know, so. The risks are different, but the rewards are different too. Because whatever first aid technique you apply is not going to save the life of that doll or make it come to life. However, when you apply what you've learned, when you've fully integrated what you have learned, in that moment of urgency, you can apply it. Because you've fully integrated it, you are it. If you have to get out the book and look, well, you're losing precious seconds. Which, it's useful to have the book to look at. It's like me with my nose, it's useful to have that. But the answer, theoretically, is not the answer in real life, in the real situation. So in a sense, you know, this all of our training in Zen that we do is first aid to apply to our life. And, you know, we chant the four vows and we say, save all these beings. But it's actually freeing them. And since they're already free, it's kind of a lost cause, right?
Some of them.
What?
Some of them are free.
Everyone is free, but they don't know it. They don't know it.
Yeah, I was thinking of animals in factory farming and whatever.
This is true. In that case, okay, then we can literally take it and free them. Yeah, that's true. Animals, in fact, they're free, but they've been condemned to servitude by us because we haven't awakened to our innate nature and their innate nature, you know. So the ones who haven't awakened to it, the animals, as far as we know, don't have that capacity to lose sight of their true nature. or to awaken to their true nature. They are it, you know. And then, of course, they become subservient to us. Absolutely. Good point, you know. But those of us who have the capacity to awaken and be free, we can awaken and become free because we already are. We just don't realize it. We don't know it. It's not like something new has added to who we are. It's just that we realize it. We awaken to it. If we weren't already free, we would not become free. You know, we don't become something that we were not already. And that, you know, that's the good news and the bad news. You know? Bad news is you're not going to become somebody else. The good news is that you're already who you are, which is already perfect, precious treasury of the true Dharma eye. That's the treasure. You already are it. You just need to realize it. If you want to, you know. And when we don't realize it, we see the consequences. We kill animals, you know. Mass killing of animals and humans, you know, and plants and life in general. We kill our own life, in fact, by not realizing it. So it's not just the life of the other, because the life of the other and my life are one. It's life, something like that. And so life and death, we chant, life and death are of supreme importance. What's also infinitely subtle about life and death is that, when we're not aware of it, is that according to, this comes from Maizumi Roshi, and I think before that from Dogen or something. In any case, every second, we are born and die 72,000 times. This is like some kind of... well, you know, yeah, I think, if I remember correctly, has anyone else read Maizumi's book, Appreciate Your Life? He cites it in that book, yeah. You know, I think Dogen said something like, maybe in a day, we... or I don't know, 6,400,000 times or something, you're born and die, death.
I'll check.
Oh, you have it, yeah. Okay. And so it's 72,000 times a second. Well, and this, you know, this fits with science and biology and physical sciences because the cells are constantly dying and being regenerated within our bodies. And I don't know how many cells we have within our bodies, but that is probably... it fits in that sense.
In yoga, you say that we have 72,000 nadis, like points of energy,
right,
in our body.
So this is, you know, probably some kind of magic Asian number, but yeah. It has meaning. What?
Yeah, it's about the nine, the seven and the two, the nine. It's about
right.
Symbolic.
So it has symbolic meaning. Like we say, 72 laborers brought us this food. But can we see it as just an infinite number of times of in every moment we are born and die?
Mm-hmm.
And then that changes how we think of living and dying and how we take care of living and dying and how we appreciate impermanence and how we look at this. You know, so if every time I'm born and die, I'm not what I was before. It's like when I said yesterday, when someone is not here, the group is different. So Miguel got up and left, group's completely different group. Margarita was not here, completely different group. Same within us. So every single moment, completely different entity, completely different... being, and yet it's all what is constant is it's always the true Dharma I. It's always that. No matter how it's modified, no matter how it changes, and you know, I know that it's very provocative to say this, but you know, even the killing of the animals and the plants and the oceans and all of that is a manifestation of that, of just this. It is what is. It doesn't mean it's beautiful and we want it to be like that, but it's a manifestation of this. All phenomena is a manifestation of that.
It's a deluded form of.
What?
It's like a deluded form of.
Exactly.
The wisdom,
right? That's right. Yeah. Exactly. It's the confused manifestation of it. Not seeing the wholeness and the oneness. And having seen the true nature and that I am that treasury of the true Dharma, I. So really, the only thing we need to do, for, you know, as we say in our sangha, or as I say, and therefore it's kind of projected onto you, is just to wake up to that, to realize that, because if we, you know, all we need to do is, this is our life, you know, the people in the kitchen are chanting that song. This is our life, the length of our days. Day and night we meditate upon it. So day and night we meditate upon this life. What is this life? Who is this life? Who am I? What is this? What is just this?
But of course you do that in everything you are doing.
Absolutely.
It's not that you are all time thinking about, I'm meditating about my life. I mean, it's.
No. If you are,
now,
then you're not.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's right. So. Absolutely.
And that's the difficulty of it.
What?
That's the difficulty of it, I would say. That's the hard aspect of it, is to be present in such a state of mind that everything you do is in this kind of mode, see, in this awakened mode. So
if you have to learn something, you can't know it beforehand. You have to learn it. So
yeah, but what I want to say is that to keep alive this awareness, that is our job.
Well, so okay. So then, you know, when we present it like that, then we have this idea that yes, in everything we do, we have to have the direct experience of the treasury of the true Dharma. I am it. This is it. I am the way. All of that. No, in every moment we don't, and it's not even that we have to. It's that the more that we, if we have that realization, like I said earlier, if we have that realization at some point, then you recognize it, you know it, and the more that you sit, you practice, you cultivate that awareness, the more then that, unbeknownst to you, like I give the image of walking through a field at dawn, when you come out of the field, you realize that your shoes and your trousers are wet. You didn't walk through that field to wet your shoes and trousers. That's what happens, though. And the same thing, Zen is like that. This practice is like that. The more that you sit, the more you cultivate this mind of awakening, this subtle mind of nirvana, the more all these words we have, the more you cultivate that and return, return, return on your cushion, then the more in all of your life it permeates, you know, it's all pervading. Isn't that what one of these? Yeah, so the Buddha says, I have the all pervading true Dharma. So the more that we do this, the more we sit, the deeper our understanding develops. Then it's not that we're thinking about it, but it is it. You manifest it. Not every moment, of course. Sometimes we forget. But then we quickly see when we're not. We more easily see when we're separate from whatever it is, from what we're doing, in a way where you respond to someone. So, you know, let's give the example of like the first 2 days of Dharma talk, which I don't even like to really think about, to be truthful. but, you know, so after, suddenly I realized, wait a minute, what? Okay, where was I going with this? You know? It doesn't mean that it was all worthless. It doesn't mean that I want to erase the talks. You know, I say there's this little voice that doesn't really want to think about it. But at the same time, it just was. And it, at that moment, it was absolutely manifesting the treasury of the True Dharma Eye. However, you know, I think because we were so much focusing on the Vajra mind, it got carried away into something that was like almost looking at itself. I don't mean I was looking at myself or you were looking at yourself, but the Vajra mind was trying to be Vajra mind or something. And we were all caught in it. It doesn't really matter. But that's an example of how, so we lose sight of it sometimes, forget. But then, because we've practiced, because this week we're all more clear than we were when we arrived. And maybe it's infinitely subtle and you don't realize it, but I realize it. When you come and sit down in front of me, you're completely different than you were when we arrived. And I'm completely different too, probably. Mm-hmm. You know? And even, you know, you can see it in people's faces, it's just more relaxed and more attentive and more aware of what's happening for yourself and for others. It's infinitely subtle. But the more that we cultivate this sitting and this returning again and again, letting go, the more we hear this, appreciate your life, appreciate this, you are the throne of enlightenment, you know, all this stuff. The more we hear that, then the more we, at some moment, we're like, oh, right. Yeah. We integrate it, and once we integrate it, then we can better manifest it. So, absolutely, we don't do it at every moment. And if we try to do it, then we're going away from it. That's the trick as well, you know? Because as soon as we're thinking about it, we're moving into duality. We're moving... Thinking is dualistic.
Has to be.
Exactly. And there's, and it's not that there's anything bad about it. Thinking is absolutely necessary, and it's the beauty of the human mind that we can do that. And can we put that thinking to use, you know, for goodness, wholeness, you know, like Mathieu Ricard says, you know, it's the and he's a scientist, right? He was trained, he was a high level training and scientist. The Pasteur Institute with the guy who, you know, discovered the AIDS. So he says, this mind of human mind is absolutely phenomenal. It's the tragedy is that instead of putting it to work, putting into action a realization of wholeness, we put into action a non-realization of wholeness and an attachment to separation. And therefore we, you know, build weapons of war instead of developing something that could, you know, alleviate hunger. Or, I don't know, something, whatever we want to say, you know. So really, you know, the practice is to so there's this, we experience this, you know, this gap, like to what kind of what Jose Eduardo was saying, it what we're doing, and then we're separate. You know, we're thinking, oh, I should be doing it this way, or this isn't good, or I wish that person would do that, or even just, you know, thinking, I'm cutting the carrots, you know. It's already being separate. I am doing something. So the whole practice is about closing that gap. Like Maizumi Urushi used to say, close the gap between yourself and yourself. Mm-hmm. So the self that is like thinking and doing and wanting and projecting, and who you truly are, this true nature. So it's all about closing the gap. And when we actually close the gap, we realize there is no gap. It's like that Confucius saying of, you know, we have two lives. The second life begins when we realize we only have one. So, in Zen, as we practice it, we have a debt to Confucius as well, because that's part of what was happening in China at the time, was Taoism and Confucianism, and the two really influenced the way that Buddhism was practiced and became Zen. So, when we see that we only have one life, that's when our second life begins. When we close that gap, we realize there is no gap. Or we say this is a path of liberation, and what we realize is that there is no liberation. We're already free. So it's important to look at the gap that we experience, you know, like what Jose Eduardo is pointing out. Look at that gap, and then say, okay, how do I close that gap? And our practice is about that, of closing that gap. It's interesting in London, you know, or even like in the Paris subway, because they translate things into English. It's always mind the gap. British English has this wonderful way of saying things that the American English does not have. Mind the gap. That's like so Zen, you know. Mind the gap. Of course, it's meaning beware of the gap between the. Oh, maybe in Ireland you have that as well, no? You
don't have a subway.
You don't have a subway.
Subway, no gap.
Exactly. I was going to say something like that.
It's not said in train stations.
What?
It's not said in train stations. It's just.
Yeah, I think it's probably because there is probably a. You know, it's not said in all subway stations in Paris either, but certain ones where the train.
There is a gap.
And there is a bigger gap than others, so.
I think in Lisbon today it's two languages, Portuguese and English.
And they say mind the gap?
Mind
the
gap. Yeah.
British English, yeah. So it's quite a phrase, though, you know, mind, to mind in British English is, you know, to beware of. So that's already amazing, you know, be aware of the gap. And it can also, sometimes I've thought of it as like, mind is the gap. Mind the gap. The mind is creating the gap. So it's, you know, we see this everywhere. And actually, you know, on some level, that's exactly what that message is telling us. You know, mind the gap. Pay attention to this gap. So can we take that to heart and say, okay, what's the gap in me? What is that gap? Pay attention to it. You know, I think Zen practitioners in London, they have a great advantage because they hear that all the time. They see that all the time, you know. They're probably not really paying attention. And it's kind of weird for me sometimes because in the Paris subway they have it and they have recordings of someone saying it. And one of the women who does the I know one of the women who does the recording. She's a poet, a British poet in Paris. And so it's like I hear Vivian telling me mind the gap. Very weird. But so I hear it differently when she says it. Mind the gap.
I've always wanted to do that because sometimes they don't get English-speaking people, and it's just, it's like a totally different language. It's not English, it's not French, it's just this thing. Be careful of the coming train. Why don't you call me?
Well, there are people who do this professionally. I think that's how my friend got involved, because she like makes a living doing voiceover and stuff like that, for commercials or movies or something. So. You know, poets have to make a living somehow. And it's not with poetry that you make a living. So, mind the gap. I'm looking to see if there's any other thing I should mind in here. Because yeah, it's like your life is it. Your life is the life of the Buddha. Here and now. And that statue there is not what we're talking about. Talking about here, now, just this. We once had there was some exhibit in Portugal with like relics of the Buddha, or I don't know, some traveling exhibit of Buddhist, wonderful Buddhist things, I don't know, you know, like objects and things. And they asked people from different traditions, teachers from different traditions, to write something about it. And about, I'm sure I had the text somewhere. So they asked me, because we're part of the Buddhist Union, to write something about it. And this was a long time ago, probably 15 years ago. And I remember it was kind of hard for me because for me, it's not about any of those things. It's not about those relics. It's not about the statues. It's not about any of that. And so I think I approached it in that way and, you know, tried to express the Zen view that, you know, the throne of enlightenment is right here, wherever you are. Maybe it had something to do with, you know, the throne of Buddha, or I don't know. Something like that.
I think it was a Tibetan kind of
exhibition
of relics.
Yeah,
I remember vaguely.
Yeah. And it was nice, though, that they asked people from different traditions, not just from the Tibetan tradition, to write something. I never actually saw what they did with that. Someone translated it, I'm sure. For some reason, it had something to do with Isabel. I don't know how she was involved with it, but maybe she translated it. I don't know. Anyway, so that's the thing, you know. This is the throne of the Buddha. This is the ground of awakening. And he, you know, when the traditional Buddha in the stories is challenged by Mara in his long night, dark night of the soul,
mm-hmm.
which is also something that comes from the Christian tradition,
yeah.
the dark night of the soul. You know, he's having his dark night of sitting there and being challenged by all these, you know, all the shadows and the darkness in his soul. And up comes this voice of Mara, that it's the same voice that we all have, of who are you to have this pretension that you can awaken? Who do you think you are? You know,
that you can, what did you?
Have this pretentious thing that you can awaken.
Awaken.
You know? Who do you think you are? You know? And the Buddha's response to Mara was, to this voice within himself, was, he's sitting there, and so the statues of that moment are. And maybe that was, one of the statues was that in that exhibit. Maybe
mm-hmm.
that's what I talked about. I don't know. That's probably why I came to the throne of enlightenment. So he has his hand on, he's sitting cross-legged, which I can't do. He has his hand on one knee and he's pointing to the ground with the other. He's, you know, he says, I take the earth as my witness. This ground here and now is it. This is the throne of enlightenment where I sit. This is it. You know, that's quite something to say, right? If we think of it as being some extraordinary place where, you know, only someone, you know, extraordinary can realize it. But if you can fully integrate, realize that you are it, that you are, that your life is the treasury of the true Dharma eye, and we just need to see it, hear it, receive and maintain it, then you realize that this is the throne of enlightenment, right here, right now. This is the ground of awakening. And that statue is a great reminder of it. Really beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
So, are we almost out of time?
What I remember.
It's getting on. 25 after.
So, yeah.
Yeah, what I remember about that is that before he makes this, I remembered from this, I think it's a beautiful movie, in fact, from Bertolucci, The Little Buddha, which there is this scene in which Mar himself shows as if he was a Buddha, as if he was an enlightened being, and saying, you did it. But that he said, no, it's not me, it's the earth, which is even more profound than that. He refuses to be the illusion of an enlightened being, something like that. See, and that is the crucial point. You don't come into a trap that you have done it.
Exactly.
That movie, I don't know if you have seen it. All of us, you have never seen it?
No.
Ah, it's a great movie.
I've seen it.
It's from the 90s or something.
It's with Keanu Reeves.
It's called Little Buddha. It's a story of...
Is that the one with Keanu Reeves?
Yeah.
He plays
the guy
Shakyamuni.
He's playing the role of the Buddha. Yeah, but then there is this other story of the Tibetan looking for, which is, I mean, there are two stories.
Yeah.
Okay,
there's
a Buddha story.
The second story I didn't get.
Yeah.
I didn't get the second story.
There's another story going on.
I understood the
yeah, to do with the Tibetan tradition and the reincarnation. And
finding
finding.
That's why it's called Little Buddha.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
You have not seen
it? Well, now that you're saying
it was
that
in the 90s.
Oh, yeah.
It was a big thing in the 90s.
Very big thing.
Yeah.
It's not Trick. Brad Pitt plays this German guy that comes.
That's another one.
Okay, then I've never seen it. So I'll have to see it.
So, yes, we... Again, that's the good news and the bad news. We're not going to become this absolute ethereal person, thing, deity living on a lotus flower, right? It's right here. Right here.